This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Rachel Iacovone. This past Friday, tragedy struck New Zealand and the world when a man entered two Christchurch mosques during morning prayers and gunned down 50 people. As of this morning, another 29 remain hospitalized, eight of whom are in critical condition in the intensive care unit. Following the massacre, New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern spoke of the shooter.
He sought many things from his act of terror, but one was notoriety. And that is why you will never hear me mention his name. He is a terrorist. He is a criminal. He is an extremist. But he will, when I speak, be nameless. And to others, I implore you, speak the names of those who were lost, rather than the name of the man who took them.
On today's show, we will not be mentioning this man by name either. Instead, we are focusing on the hurt and the healing of the Muslim community and the unfortunate connection between Muslims and Jews right now in the wake of yet another targeted shooting. Joining us now in studio is Imam Muhammad Al-Darsani of the Islamic Center for Peace in Fort Myers. Imam Al-Darsani, thank you for joining us again. I wish it were under better circumstances.
Thank you for having me.
Also here is Rabbi Nicole Luna of Temple Beth El in Fort Myers. Rabbi Luna, thank you for being here.
Glad to be here.
And as always, we invite you to join our conversation. The number to call is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. To begin, Imam Al-Darsani, I just want to ask how you're doing.
Given the circumstances, I think I'm doing all right. And we're doing well, actually, especially living in Southwest Florida. Out of every tragedy, sometimes some good come out. We have many, many people who expressed their supports, who physically showed up at our centers and offered their condolences and their support. And anything they can do, they've been asking anything we can do. And it's been wonderful. One of them, actually, Rabbi Luna here beside me, she was one of the first ones to reach out and offer her support, condolences. And in a time like this, it is very encouraging to know the majority of the people around us are great people, not just good. They really are great. And we have a few we have to work on.
Even in the wake of a shooting like this, you still think people are great?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Goodness of people will always exist. And the struggle between good and evil will go till the end of times. Struggle between right and wrong will go on. It's just where you choose to be, which side you're going to be on. And we encourage people to be on the good side, on the right side. And we try to connect with them. And we found the majority of people, as I said, are of that kind.
So for us, it was Thursday night when the Friday attacks had happened in New Zealand. I assume you heard the news before your morning prayers, so I wanted to ask.
Well, actually, I heard the news as it happened. We have, you know, everybody has the apps on their phone, mobile phones now and stuff. Right when we went to bed, my wife and I were getting in bed when the alert came and shooting in New Zealand. I knew it was going to be a big news the next morning, and it was, and still, and it should be until people wake up, and especially people of responsibilities who have some authority, do something and follow probably the footsteps of the Prime Minister of New Zealand, who's showing tremendous leadership in this area.
Has there been a particular passage or a verse that you've been going back to as you're getting through this?
Well, there are many passages and verses in there, but basically, there is a verse in the Quran that, in a chapter that summarizes the whole faith, 1/4 of our devotions and practices should be concentrated around patience and perseverance. So that's the refuge for us right now, perseverance.
The first burials are beginning today. There was a rush to release the bodies to families so proper Muslim funerals could be conducted. So they were saying they kept using the term proper Muslim funerals, and I don't know if people maybe understand the process. Can you go through what a burial was like traditionally?
Sure, absolutely. Just like it is in Judaism and in Christianity too, there are proper ways of preparing the body for burial and burying the body. We don't believe in cremations. The only way Muslims do burials is to prepare the body in a certain way, shroud it, and put it in the ground, because we came from the earth and to the earth will our body should return. So, and we are encouraged to do that as soon as possible. So you don't wait a day or two or three. Sometimes within hours, the body's done and buried. And that's the reason most of the families are asking to do so. Now, I don't know what the law requires in New Zealand. However, the laws here, there are requirements in the United States and in every state we have to follow, and we follow that. And most of the time, they are in sync with the Islamic rules. They never interfered with our rules. The body in normal situation must be washed, cleansed, similar to baptism actually performed on the body, and then prepared, put a shroud around it, put it in a coffin, and put it in the ground as soon as you can, and perform a prayer before you do that, the funeral prayer. Many prayers are offered in the world right now, not just by the Muslims, by many different religious people, from all kind of people, actually. They are performing prayers on behalf of those who passed in this horrible massacre.
Yes, a lot of videos of the Hakka traditional dance has been going around that is performed in funerals by the Maori people of New Zealand. You've seen a lot of those, and that's not necessarily religious
based. No, but this is an expression that, the people in New Zealand are, doing to express their sorrow and to express their support. And I'm sure there are Christians who did, in their way, perform certain prayers. Jews, Muslims, all kind of people are doing that. We heard of that.
So I hate to ask this, but are hate crimes like this a surprise to you anymore?
Honestly, no. I'm not surprised at all. I'm not shocked either. What really concerns me is the attitude of certain people, and certain people in leadership, actually. That's really the surprising thing to me. How many people have to die before we take actions? How many people have to suffer before we stand up and say we have to do something about something that is wrong, completely wrong? We've been fighting against it for so long, for ages. Rabbi Luna is sitting beside me right now, and she will take you back thousands of years of oppressions and discriminations and supremacy. The extremism that the white supremacy or any supremacy, there is black supremacy, there is white supremacy, there is brown supremacy, there is a supremacy in every culture and in every corner of the world. But the way we need to deal with it here in the most advanced country in the world, the most advanced nation, the oldest democracy in the world. And if we fail, guess what? The whole world will follow. And we are going to fail humanity. And I wish we can speak about that later on in the program in more details.
Of course. I'm going to pose the same question now to Rabbi Luna. Did this surprise you? Do hate crimes in general surprise you anymore?
Unfortunately, I think we in some ways have come to expect them because of this rise in white supremacy, because of this rise in hatred. And it is very scary, I think, for our communities to know that this is a real possibility.
Imam Al-Darsani, I saw you when I was covering actually the Temple Shalom Solidarity Shabbat, and you were there and you were leading the congregation in prayer after it was the Tree of Life shooting, 5 months ago now? So when you were up there, did you think that your own community would be struck by similar tragedy?
Absolutely. Not just my own community. I mean, we witnessed the shooting again in the synagogues, the massacre in the synagogue. People were worshiping. I mean, this is not surprising, this is mind-boggling, really. You target people in places of worship. I mean, how low we are getting. Shooting in synagogues, shooting in churches, black and white churches. It is happening, you know, on a scale right now. The frequencies of those incidents is extremely alarming, not just to the Muslims. I mean, okay, you killed 50 Muslims. Go ahead and kill 50 million Muslims. You still 1.8 billions to go through. I mean, what in the world are you thinking? You kill white Christians worshiping. I mean, that's recent incidents. We don't want to name the criminals, the terrorists who committed those acts. But at synagogues, at churches, black churches, at mosques, at temples, Hindu temples were attacked in the recent years. Where we're going to wake up? What is going to take until we wake up? Do we need to get some leaders, put them in a church or a synagogue or in a mosque, and then bring a shooter so they can wake up and take actions and start directing the attention toward this problem that is really, really demonizing people and at the same time is hurting our democracy and hurting our country and dividing our people in a way that never happened before?
If you're just joining the show today, I'm talking to Imam Muhammad al-Dasani and Rabbi Nicole Luna about the intersection of anti-Semitism and Islamophobia in the wake of another targeted attack. If you would like to add your voice to the conversation, you can give us a call now. The number is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Rabbi Luna, I want to turn to you now. It's been almost 5 months since the Tree of Life shooting that killed 11 Jewish people and injured another 8 in their place of worship. Do you remember the moment that you heard the news?
Yes, it was right after we celebrated a bat mitzvah, a coming-of-age ceremony, and we were in a joyful mood, a celebratory mood. And to know that this tragedy, the shooting, had happened at the same time as we were worshiping in our own sanctuary was so disturbing and heartbreaking.
And I'll ask you what I asked Imam al-Dasani earlier. Is there a passage or verse that's been getting you through this?
I've been reflecting a lot on a verse from Ecclesiastes 9:10 that says, "Whatever is in your power to do, la'asot bechochecha, say, do it with all your might." And whether that means thinking about the protection and security of our synagogue, but also about living out our Jewish values, living fully as proud Jews, doing it with all our might, not being cowered into hiding, but saying that we are going to be proud about our Jewish identity and celebrate it fully.
Is there ever a fear after these types of attacks to go into not being proudly Jewish, hiding maybe the fact that you are?
There's always a balance between fear and pride in one's identity. Certainly, we have taken steps to review our security procedures, but we also greatly value being welcoming and being aware that there are people who are wanting to hurt us, but at the same time that we have plenty of support within the community, that we have people who care about us, that support us. We were greatly honored by the outpouring of solidarity that came. Our sanctuary was full with over 800 people, and we are grateful to know that there are good people in the world.
You mentioned some of the changes to security, and it might be too soon to ask, but I want to turn it back to you for a moment and ask you, is there any talk right now in your community about changing security here locally?
Well, in the Muslim community, that has been going on for a few years, actually, and we have some organizations that going around and offering security training and implementing security procedures in most of the mosques in the United States. Now, when you go to a mosque or a church or a synagogue, you really feel at peace. As soon as you enter, you are at peace. You think you are coming to a sacred place where you are connecting with the divine. you don't expect, you know, somebody is coming to kill you right there. This is the last thing on your mind usually. However, in today's world, I think people will rethink all of that. And it is shame. It is shame to feel that you are going to worship no matter what temple, what house of worship you're going to feel insecure and to feel that there should be an armed guard out there to protect you. That never happened before, and it shouldn't happen.
We actually have a caller right now, so speaking of the local community, I'm going to turn it to Katie in Naples.
Hi, yeah. My question plus comment is just on the statement of being on the good side of good versus evil. I understand what was being said there, but I feel like it was a little bit of looking at a coin and there's a good and a bad side. And although we can all agree that, you know, shooting in a church is absolutely wrong, what happens when the shooter or the terrorist thinks that they're doing something for the good of their own cause? And, you know, how do we change the language to say, you know, have some understanding that they did this thinking that they're doing something good. They thought they were maybe bringing down an enemy. And how do we shift that focus that, hey, this is absolutely wrong, and even though you did it in something you thought was good, you know, there's not really a good and evil, I guess is what my statement is.
Well, thank you, Katie. I will pose this right now. They're making faces at each other, so I think you both might have a comment on this.
Yes, let me start.
Okay.
Katie, thank you so much. You brought something that is extremely important. No doubt, everybody, when they commit an act like that, in their mind, they believe they are doing the right thing. And what I meant, really, what everybody means when we talk against this, we want to talk against the ideology these people are fed. There are extremists, bad people in every religion and in every group and every ideology and every political party. And if they can get their way to advance and impose their views on the others by force, they will do it. What we need to do really as people, especially people of faith, I come from the faith of Islam, Rabbi Luna comes from the Jewish faith, and I have many, many, many friends of the Christian faith who are against the violence, especially in the name of religion, and also against the atmosphere that allows that to happen. I'm not talking about imposing laws only. I'm talking about allowing the good people, people of faith, or even if not faithful, but they are good people, to work and promote different ideology and different strategies even to combat this. Our children and our young people really are not receiving, and I say this loudly and from the bottom of my heart, enough moral upbringing and spiritual upbringing to rely on when evil thoughts come their ways. We are not providing that. The church, the mosque, the synagogue, the temples are failing in providing that. We became so concentrating on materialism, individualism, and all kind of other isms except the well-being of the human soul. That is being destroyed. And when the souls of the human is destroyed, then everything goes. You don't look at the human being as a sacred, sanctified, God's creation, the best creature God put in this universe is the human being. If we don't view each other like that, we are so precious to our Creator, it's easy to destroy the others. When you demonize them, they're not worthy of life, they're not worthy of being with me, then eliminate them. What's the deal? And that's what's happening. We need to rely on the moral and spiritual and ethical teaching again, not just laws. You can pass 1 million laws against guns, against bigotry. You'll still find people who will find their ways to guns, and they are bigots, and they'll use them. Same thing with drugs. How long the war on drugs been going on? And all we see increase in the drugs problems. Same thing with the guns and other things. You have some moral-based teaching and strategy to combat that.
So, Rabbi Luna, I'm going to pose the same question that Katie had to you. What can people do if it seems almost like the bystander effect is what you had mentioned? It's if people aren't speaking out against hate, they're seeing hate in their communities and maybe someone's unwilling to hear it, then what can we do to change their mind if they've made up their mind already?
Well, certainly the idea of education is crucial in Judaism. There's a principle called B'Tselem Elohim of understanding that everybody is made in the image of God and that difference is not something to be afraid of or to cause deeper division, but that it's something to be celebrated. I think having a good sense of curiosity about our neighbors, about understanding their traditions and their customs, and encouraging that sense of unity and that sense of knowledge rather than ignorance and fear leading to hate. And so in addition to those deep moral values that Imam al-Darsani is mentioning, just the idea of educating others about what does it mean to be Jewish, what does it mean to be Muslim, and to encourage that sense of curiosity to learn about others and to want to get to know our neighbors better.
So I'm going to turn it back now to what we've been talking about, this recent incident and, of course, the Tree of Life shooting. I want to kind of educate people on what both your faiths might say about how to grieve. Is there verses that you are taught, different practices in your faith for the steps in the grieving process? Whoever wants to answer that first.
Yes, in Judaism, we have a set process for grieving. The first 7 days is the most intense period of mourning. It's called Shiva. And that is really a time when the mourners are not expected to even go to synagogue. The community comes to them, supports them, reaches out to them. And then the next period is called Shloshim, which is a month after the death. And then finally, really, mourning takes place over an entire year, recognizing that one's life has changed, that one's routines and habits are different, and to allow that person and that community a full year at least to respond to the new normal, to respond to their new reality, and to get used to the changes in their lives and the deep loss that they've experienced.
We have similar practices also. The first 3 days to us in Islam are the most crucial ones. Then you have a period of 40 days, and you have in some cultures a period of a year, or sometimes some, especially spouses, they extend the period for themselves of a grieving. And there are prayers you can recite. And then there is a visitation to the graveyard on regular basis. Some people, they go weekly. Some people, sometimes daily. It depends on how close to they are close to the one who passed away. On the first day, especially the first day and first 3 days, the families of the deceased, you know, are supported tremendously. People will bring food. People will bring anything they need. They try to let them relax a little bit and process, you know, the incident. And prayers are the most. And then we are encouraged to remember that God brought us here and God will take us back. And we hope we can meet again in heaven. And you keep praying for the forgiveness for those who passed away. And you keep praying that also, on the day of judgment, they'll have an easy pass.
If I'm joined today by Imam Mohammed al-Darsani and Rabbi Nicole Luna, we're exploring the intersection of anti-Semitism and Islamophobia in the wake of another targeted attack. If you would like to join our conversation, please give us a call now. The number is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. NPR's Morning Edition recently ran a feature by reporter Kirk Zeigler called A Mainstreaming of Bigotry as White Extremism Reveals Its Global Reach. Let's listen to that now.
Last week's mass shooting in New Zealand was an extreme example of white nationalist violence. But while it's extreme, it is not alone. White hate ideology is rising around the globe, and especially in the United States. NPR's Kirk Zeigler reports.
It's a common misconception that your average white supremacist is some disaffected white guy with economic anxieties, according to Kathy Blee, who studies white extremism at the University of Pittsburgh. Her research shows middle-class and even upper-middle-class men from the mainstream are increasingly getting drawn into this movement, which is mostly online and worldwide. We reached her while traveling through the Detroit airport.
A lot of them are very casual viewers initially, and they get pulled into these very extreme ideas.
Blee says this online world is a lot more convoluted and complicated than we think. People who are already spending huge amounts of time online discover or are recruited into racist communities, and they become radicalized, and some are prone to act on this anger urgently.
It's more that this world can create people who are aimless, marginalized, isolated, and quite extreme in their thinking.
Blee was as horrified as the next person about the murders at the New Zealand mosques, but maybe not as surprised. Here in the U.S., there's been a spike in white supremacist-motivated violence and murders. According to the Anti-Defamation League, ideologically motivated extremists killed at least 50 people in the U.S. last year, according to preliminary figures. And all but one of those murders had at least some link to right-wing extremism. Just one, according to a recent report, was blamed on Islamist extremism. And therein lies another widespread and dangerous misconception, says Brian Levin. He heads the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at Cal State San Bernardino.
This threat of homegrown, far-right-wing, white nationalism, terrorism, and extremism is the most prominent threat.
Since 2015, Levin says Islamist extremism directed at Westerners has dropped. That movement has splintered as white extremism has strengthened.
And during these periods of polarization and when there is declining trust in communal institutions, who gets targeted? Immigrants, foreigners, people of color, and Jews.
Speaking to reporters after the attacks, President Trump said he didn't believe white nationalism is on the rise. Experts say the hard numbers prove the opposite.
Well, we're not getting much, if any, national leadership in terms of how to respond to hate and extremism.
At Chapman University in Southern California, sociology professor Pete Simi says whether intentional or not, President Trump also speaks the language of white supremacists when he makes derogatory remarks about immigrants and the countries they come from and repeatedly talks about a, quote, invasion at the U.S.-Mexican border. He did so again on Friday when vetoing Congress's attempt to block his emergency declaration.
We're on track for 1 million illegal aliens to rush our borders. People hate the word invasion, but that's what it is.
When you have a president who's endorsing those ideas and using that kind of language, it does send the message that, hey, you know, this is not only permissible, it's encouraged.
After the New Zealand attack, a White House spokesperson called it outrageous to make any connection to Trump, saying the president has repeatedly condemned bigotry and racism. Kirk Zeigler, NPR News, Los Angeles.
That was a feature that ran on NPR's Morning Edition a few days after last week's terrorist attack in New Zealand. I want to turn back to you both now and just get your reactions to that story.
Okay, I'll start. I will give you two examples happened with me, one last week and the one before. To illustrate the ignorance that is out there, seriously, and there are people promoting these kind of things in all religions. Rabbi Luna talked about education. Unfortunately, a Muslim does not have to come and educate people only about Islam or non-Muslims. We have to educate our own also. Same thing in the synagogues. Same should apply in churches and any other places of worship. Teaching people about the sacredness of the human life and the preciousness of the human being. That is missing in all religions, by the way. I said I'll give you two examples. Example number one, a Muslim person, but traditional Muslim, born to a Muslim family, does not know much about what the religion teaches, filled throughout her life with ideas about the West and America, and the West is the enemy of Islam. I have two kids. I have four children. Two of them are in the U.S. Army. And the question came to me from that person, highly educated person too, but highly educated in worldly matters, not in her religion. How in the world your kids are in an army that is an enemy of the Muslims? Okay? And I had to sit down and really do a mini lecture to explain to her the American army is not the enemy of the Muslims. There are wars between Muslims and the United States of America, that, no doubt. But they are not really the enemy. There are causes have nothing to do with Islam. The other example, somebody who worked for me, and I'm sure she's not listening. She doesn't know what NPR station is on the dial. In her late 30s, supposedly enlightened, no. Suddenly found Jesus, and I became her enemy within a week. I knew who she was listening to. We have teachers, we have preachers preaching hates. We have rabbis, imams, pastors, and you name it, in every religion, even Hindus and Buddhist monks and gurus, doing the same exact thing. As we speak right now, there is somebody somewhere in the world killed in the name of the religion of somebody else because he's different and he practices or believes different things. So the education should start within our circles and extend it and cooperate with other people. We had programs between Temple Bethel, the Islamic Center for Peace, and many other churches. We designed educational program for our people to come and learn about the others and see how we can work together on doing good in this world. That must be propagated. That must be advanced. That we should do 10 times more than what we are doing right now in order at least to catch up with what's going around us. Otherwise, we all going to be targets. No doubt about it.
I actually want to turn this now to you, Rabbi Luna, to talk about what today is, which is the beginning of Purim, which highlights a long history of persecution of the Jewish people. And it's just one time they were saved. So I want to backtrack for people who have never heard the story of Esther. Can you give us the rundown?
Yes, certainly. Purim begins this evening, and the story starts with the king of Persia in modern-day Iran. King Ahasuerus is looking for a new queen, and he chooses Esther, but doesn't know that she is Jewish. And the evil villain of the story is the egotistical and power-hungry advisor to the king named Haman. And he demands that everybody in Persia bow down to him. But Queen Esther's cousin, Mordechai, refuses to bow down as a Jew. And Haman becomes furious and goes to the king and convinces the king to enact his plot to kill all the Jews. Now, when Mordechai hears this, he goes to Queen Esther and tells her that she has to go to the king to plead for her people. This was actually a dangerous idea because no one was allowed to go to the king without being summoned. They could be put to death. So Purim celebrates Queen Esther's bravery and courage in standing up against this injustice, going to the king, revealing that she is Jewish, and ultimately saving her people.
So when did Purim become a holiday to celebrate? In that moment, the second that they were saved, or later in history?
So the end of the story of Esther, the book of Esther in our Hebrew Bible, ends with instructions about celebrating this moment of survival and continuing it for all generations.
I've heard it called the Jewish Halloween before. So for people who have not heard of it, how is this celebrated?
Purim is a very joyous holiday. It's a day of survival, but it's really a day that we celebrate who we are. So we read the story of Esther, and we do dress up in costume, reminding us of how Esther masked her identity to the king and then revealed herself. And we boo when we hear the name of Haman. We stomp our feet. And it's a day of rejoicing. We are commanded to enjoy a festive meal, to give gifts to our friends, to give charity to the poor, and to live out our Jewish values.
So how is it celebrated in different countries? I feel like even here in our newsroom when this came up, not everyone had heard of it, but some people who had spent time in Europe in particular were like, oh yeah, it's a huge celebration, but we're not seeing it on the streets maybe here.
Well, certainly I think one of the biggest customs and traditions is to eat a pastry called Hamantaschen, which is a three-cornered cookie that is filled with jelly or chocolate or poppy seed and represents either Haman's hat or Haman's ears, but is part of the celebratory nature of Purim.
So how important is this holiday to the Jewish faith?
It is one of our essential stories of survival. It reminds us that it takes courage and bravery to live out our Jewish lives proudly and fully, that we're also expected to stand up against injustice like Queen Esther did, but ultimately to rejoice in who we are and with our community.
This is just one example of many throughout history where the Jewish people have looked death in the face. So how is the story of Esther taught to those who practice in modern times?
I think with the rise of anti-Semitism, certainly this story takes on a deeper meaning. One of the ways that Haman convinced the king to kill the Jews was by speaking about their difference, saying that there was a certain people who had different customs and laws, and convincing the king that that they were other. But Esther really challenges this by going directly to the king, by revealing that she is Jewish and showing how wrong it is to view the Jews as other.
So her similarities would make the other seem more similar.
Yes, and she also shows that you don't have to choose between country and your faith. She goes directly to the king. She uses her power and proves that she is devoted both to her country and to Judaism.
So what are the implications of Esther's story now in the wake of the Holocaust, in the wake of the Tree of Life shooting?
Well, one thing that is interesting about the book of Esther is that God's name is not mentioned in the book. And certainly, sometimes we feel that sense of divine abandonment, but still holding out hope, still remaining hopeful for our survival, and also knowing that we have to take action as well. In the story of Esther, Mordechai says to Queen Esther, perhaps it was just for this moment that you were made queen. And for us to say, perhaps it is for this moment that we are made now to stand up, to educate, to reach out to our neighbors and to our friends, to support others, and to share that message of unity.
For people who might be going through that, the what do I do moments, what do you tell everyone who might be coming to you after a moment like this, the Tree of Life shooting, and they're saying, what can I do? I feel overwhelmed and I feel like such a small person. I remember Esther says that at some point. It's like, just me, you know, this one Jewish person, and she changes the course of history. So that's one example. But what can you tell someone who's on the ground here, a small person per se?
Well, I always encourage those in the Jewish community that the way to respond to anti-Semitism is to take pride in one's Jewish identity and not to hide it, to share it with those around them and to let them know that this is who a Jewish person is, somebody who loves the United States, somebody who is active in their community, somebody who is a work colleague, to be proud of who they are, and also to use it as an opportunity to deepen their faith, to truly learn what does it mean to be Jewish, to truly become more involved in the congregation, and to be able to take pride and to understand their identity.
I want to actually turn to you, Amama Dasani, for a second and ask, is there any holidays similarly? Because it seems like there's some crossovers oftentimes with Judaism and the Islam faith and Christianity, where is there a holiday about persecution in particular?
No. And, you know, although we share a lot of commonalities in the faith and the belief system, however, our holidays are different. The Muslim, let's say the Muslim world or the Muslim people did not have the history the Jewish people had. They didn't have the persecution the Jewish or the Christian did have. In fact, it was totally different, different narrative, let's put it this way, and different events. However, recently that is happening in the last century, and now that there is some persecutions against Muslims. And really, it is not directed against Muslims alone. This criminal, white supremacist terrorist in New Zealand, he was directing his anger and his hate not just toward Muslims because they are Muslims, toward immigrants. Okay. So we have a duty here, especially in the West, especially those who are immigrants like me, myself. We have a duty to educate and to show people, like Rabbi Luna said, not just being a Jew and show your, you know, Jewishness or Islamistness or Christianity and be proud of it only. No, educate the others and tell them, if it weren't for the immigrants, the whole United States wouldn't exist. That's number one. And just because you came here first, that does not give you total ownership and a deed for the land. That's number two. Number three, your color does not make you better than any other color. In fact, all other colors prettier than white. I hate to say it, but that's the truth. And the idea my color is superior to yours, or my blood is better than yours, or my ethnicity is different from yours and better than yours, that should go away. In Islam, we have a great teaching, and it is in the Quran and from the traditions of the prophets. People are equal in the sight of God. It doesn't matter what you look like. God is not interested in your color or in your shape. God is interested in your soul and in your heart. The reasons we have all these problems, we have similar crimes committed by non-whites. When people feel oppressed, when people feel they are treated unjustly, and they are fed with misinformation and lies about who's causing their misery or their injustice, they react. And some take it to extremes, like we just saw in New Zealand. We have to change that. If we don't go to the causes of all of these problems and we treat the symptoms only and talk about the symptoms, it is not going to change. It's going to get worse. We have to address what is causing this. There's a hate speech. There is misinformation out there. We have a leader who's telling every poor American, the immigrants are your problem. Or every victim, the immigrants are the ones who are killing you. While the reality is totally the opposite, and he chooses to deny. We heard that in the segment you played. He is in denial, and there are, if somebody of his caliber is in denial, can you imagine a small, ignorant person, poor, miserable, and on top of it, uneducated, how they would think and react? Could be.
If you're just tuning in, we're joined in studio today by Rabbi Nicole Luna from Temple Beth El in Fort Myers and Imam Muhammad Al-Drasani from the Islamic Center for Peace, also in Fort Myers. We're exploring the intersection of anti-Semitism and Islamophobia in the wake of last week's terrorist attack in Christchurch, New Zealand. If you would like to add your voice to our conversation, give us a call now at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Rabbi Luna, as a fellow leader of a faith who is going through the stages of grief following a massacre of people in their place of worship, what wisdom can you impart upon Imam Al-Drasani about how the next few months will feel guiding his community through this?
I think it's important to honor the fear and real concern. The security concerns are real. We both said that, unfortunately, these tragedies are no longer a surprise. We know that it is possible and the importance of taking steps to protect and secure ourselves, while at the same time living out those values. In Judaism, we read in the Hebrew Bible and the Torah to love the stranger, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. So making sure that in the midst of our fear and our worry, that we are still caring for the stranger. We are still caring for those who are most vulnerable among us, and making sure that those values of reaching outward are still carried out.
So there are certainly some battles still waging between members of both the Jewish and Islamic faiths, depending on where you are in the world. But here in the U.S., it seems more and more both groups are saying their persecution is practically the same. And we're hearing that even today. So, Rabbi Luna, I'm going to begin with you. Can someone stand against anti-Semitism without standing against Islamophobia as well?
Well, I certainly think that they have different causes and are expressed in different ways. But certainly, once you say that you shouldn't hate a person because of their Jewish religion, then yes, you should not hate a person because they practice the Muslim faith or the Christian faith or any other faith as well.
When you say it that way, it sounds so simple. How about you? I'm going to turn it to you vice versa. Can you stand against Islamophobia without being against anti-Semitism?
In fact, it's mandated to us in the Quran. That's the core of Islam, is in the Quran. God says, if it weren't for people standing together against those who are trying to destroy their places of worship, God didn't say the Muslims, God didn't say the Jews or the Christians, he said people, if it weren't for people standing together to prevent that, what something like what happened, masjids, meaning places of worship of Muslims, churches, synagogues, and other places God permitted for his name to be worshipped and for him to be glorified and worshipped in, would be destroyed. This is an encouragement not to stand up against who's going against the masjid, to protect and stand against anybody who is targeting any religion, regardless who it is. And we extend our support to our Jewish friends and even Christians. Black Christians are targeted. I mean, we keep talking about Muslims and Jews. Black Christians were targeted in their churches. We know that. I mean, that's recent history. It just we tend to forget so soon. And we need all to stand together. No matter what religion we came from, we have to defend against this wave that really is taking over because of some ignorant people.
So in the wake of these types of incidents, people often come to, I'm assuming you both, but also us, even as a station, will get people reaching out, how can I help? And we don't necessarily have the answer, so I'm going to pose that to you both. You first, Imam Al-Drasani, because unfortunately, you had the most recent shooting, and I want to pose it to you both of what can people do locally to help both communities?
Absolutely. First of all, everybody must do what they can do. And that doesn't mean, okay, what your convenience permits you to do. Get out of your comfort zone and do something. the least you can start by a phone call. That's at the minimum if you cannot do anything. Visit an Islamic center. Visit a synagogue and tell them, you're my friend, you're my neighbor, and I'm here with you. We had people like that last Friday. Last Friday, we had people came with their signs, stood in front of the mosque. People came with flour to offer. That happened on 9/11 too, by the way. Although the perpetrators supposedly were Muslims, but we had people coming to say, we don't believe you people are the same, and we are with you against that too. So we encourage them to do that. Find a program. Rabbi Luna offers a program at her synagogue. I used to offer classes also about educating about Islam. We formed an interfaith group to educate people and our people too about the different religions. Find a group. Find a program where you can go and learn. Find a project. And I hope we can, out of this will come many projects, not just in Southwest Florida, all over the nation, to do constructive, positive things to educate the people and to make people aware of the problems we are having and maybe help prevent the upcoming events or crime.
So, Rabbi Luna, I'll ask you the same. How can people help the Jewish community?
I think it's very Jewish to answer a question with a question. So I will encourage everyone to really ask, what need do I see in my community? What need is there? And then once they have identified that, I think when the entire community is strengthened, when people are working together, when people see that we are similar in our humanity, then every community is strengthened, then every community is more safe. So whether that is volunteering wherever you are, really seeing what needs to be done and saying, I'm going to make a difference today.
Well, that's a great place to close it. That's all the time we have for today's show. So thank you to my guests, Rabbi Nicole Luna from Temple Beth El in Fort Myers and Imam Muhammad Al-Dasani from the Islamic Center for Peace, also in Fort Myers. If you missed part of today's show, you can always hear episodes in their entirety on our website, GulfCoastLive.org. Or you can subscribe to our podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts. Our show today was produced by Mike Canary and myself. Our director is Richard Chinqui, and our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Rachel Iacovone. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.